Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today is back. Ilaria Kapua, Professor Kapua, is the director of the One Health Initiative. Do I have that correct?
I am the director of the One Health Center of Excellence here at UF. But I want to talk to you about the One Health Initiative.
Okay.
Whilst we're at it.
Yeah. Well, so for everyone who is listening who hasn't yet heard about One Health, this is not even necessarily a new way of conceptualizing the environment and the sort of health of the earth and all the things that live on the earth. But it is certainly one that is perhaps not as well known as it should be. I think that, like a lot of people, I formerly just thought of individual species as what they are, and I thought of the oceans as the oceans, and I thought of the sky as the sky, and I thought of food crops as just being food crops. And of course, I kind of understood that humans have an important role to play in all of this.
Because they are in charge. Had you ever thought about it?
Right.
We are in charge of other living organisms and also of the health of matter, which is not alive.
The connectivity of all of this is probably more extensive than people understand. Why do you think it's taken until now for people to imagine it this way, by and large?
But actually, you know, the One Health vision has been with us for much longer than you can imagine. I have one of my scholars is a classics graduate from UF. Her name is Sara Agnelli. And she is looking into how ancient Greeks used to look at health. And actually, they had cracked it because they had understood that there was an interconnect. I mean, they didn't have the method, right? And they didn't have, let's say, the science because it was many, many years ago. But they got it that we are in the midst of a connected environment, and we are connected through the air, we are connected through water, we are connected through movement. And so the One Health concept has been with us for a long time. It's just that as technology has developed, I think that we fail to see all the opportunities that One Health offers to veterinary students, to veterinary professionals, public health professionals, medical professionals, but also to engineers, data scientists, physicists, mathematicians. We need them.
Certainly. Now, I think about the ancient Greeks, and they were dealing with a world that to us would seem almost comically small relative to the way that we sort of have expanded our scope. And they had forms of agriculture, for instance, that were much less mechanized. I mean, virtually unmechanized, maybe animal power at best. And we have now agriculture at a massive industrial scale. In fact, almost everything we do is at a massive industrial scale.
Even drinking coffee.
Right.
Right.
So we've got to develop solutions that meet the challenges that we all will face if we do nothing.
Exactly. So we need to develop solutions that are mindful that there are other compartments in that given problem that may suffer from that solution. Let me just give you an example. A few years ago, Florida was threatened by the Zika epidemic. Everybody was worried about Zika epidemic, rightly so. And as you know, Zika is a vector-borne disease, and so it's transmitted by mosquitoes. And so one of the first reactions to that was, okay, we need to do some more spraying. But what happened was that they did spray, and the mosquito population went down. But what happened is that also the bee population went down. And that is something that we cannot afford because bees are extremely important to our survival. Bees are pollinators, and bees keep life on Earth going. That's what they say. And so when I talk about One Health, I try and make people understand that health is an extremely complex issue. And what you just said about the ancient Greeks had cracked it, and they had a less complicated life than we do. We are highly mechanized, but we are also highly globalized and greatly interconnected through trade, for example. People movement, look at, I mean, Florida is where everybody wants to be and where everybody wants to go. And people carry themselves, carry their families, but they carry their pets. They carry diseases. They carry invasive species. They don't even know that they're carrying them, but they can carry them and bring them into the state. And therefore, we need to develop a culture around the One Health concept.
So where will that begin? Will that begin with educating young people?
Absolutely. And we have, actually, you're giving me a ball to smash. Yeah, so we have just finished voting for our One Health Day contest. We developed this idea of asking UF students to catch the movement and how it influences health. We need to start thinking out of the box. And so we launched the contest. We looked at the artworks. We have our winners, and they will be presented with their awards next week. And the reason why we launched this is because we need to get young students to think about the One Health perspective. And actually, I want to thank all the students who participated in the contest, because their artwork was always, so of course, I mean, not everybody can win, but there was a lot of thought behind that artwork. And this makes me happy, because I think that we might be being able to put a crack into awareness, and maybe next year we'll have a much bigger contest.
Well, so if we think about this and imagine that young people sort of going through school now will be much more likely to be aware of One Health than, for instance, when I was coming up through school. Not that it didn't exist, because as you said, the idea's been around for a long time. But if young people today are growing up in a world in which they perceive of the world as being interconnected in all these different ways, do you feel like that will make a big difference in the future in terms of coming up with solutions for these problems?
Well, absolutely. And the solutions need to be different from the solutions that we have explored in the past, because the solutions that we have explored in the past have turned out to have some negative ramifications. And so we need to rethink them on the basis of our new knowledge, but also of the new technology that we have.
I think that many people will have heard recently about the rather ominous report. I believe maybe the United Nations put it together, or a group of scientists, international scientists, put together a report that stated that if left uncontrolled, or at least as we're currently projected to go, the warming of the Earth will be significant enough that the effects will be not just long-lasting, but perhaps irreversible. And I think many people, when hearing this, you understandably feel powerless, like one person might feel like he or she couldn't really do much about it, and that may be. But even then, I think a lot of us maybe haven't even understood how, for instance, the warming of the oceans by a few tenths of a degree, or even a degree, would be that meaningful. But that really matters, and that's a very obvious example of the way that, you know, human beings are connected with the environment. But we don't maybe necessarily even know all the other different ways that it could be bad.
Yeah. So, okay, you made the example of the ocean. And for those of you who are listening to us who have an aquarium, you will know that the temperature needs to be controlled very well, because if the temperature is altered, fish, of course, they suffer, fish or whatever creatures are in there. But they're particularly sensitive to the temperature, because there is an equilibrium inside that tank, and temperature is a very important part of that equilibrium. And so even as you say, you know, we say 1/10 of a degree. What's 1/10 of a degree? 1/10 of a degree is 1/10. It's not 1/1,000,000 of a degree. So that's point number one. And point number two, it has been shown that even 0.1 or 0.2 or 0.3 degrees higher can completely alter that balance. And living creatures suffer. And then if they start suffering, you get into a spiral in which they just, if it goes over that tipping point, they won't be able to recover. Especially primitive organisms.
Do you feel that for many people, the problem that we're perceiving is one that matters only insofar as it's an economic problem?
I think the critical point in this line of thinking is that it may be too late. What you said is, you know, climate scientists say is that the change in temperature, and it's not like the change in the maximum temperature, it's a change on the average temperature. So, you know, you said Florida's hot. Yes, it is, and it has been very hot this summer. But we're not talking about extremes.
Right.
We're talking about the average temperature. And the problem is that we don't know when that process will be largely irreversible, because, of course, you know, irreversible is a big word, but we don't really know where that point is going to be where we will still be able to do something to invert the trend, or where it will be too late and also less cost efficient. So my suggestion is that each one of us should do what is in his or her power to understand the complexity of the environment we live in and understand the challenges that are coming because of global warming, but also because of massive traveling, because of globalization, because of ecosystems that have been disrupted, and therefore that's when emerging infectious diseases come out. And so it's, you know, it's nearly like looking at, you know, an orchestra. The orchestra plays all together, and the sound that comes out of that orchestra is a sound that also comes from the oboe. And you'll get
right.
The oboe in the background, and you probably won't even notice it, but you can hear it, and it's part of that. And so we need to understand that health of animals, health of humans, and health of the environment are very tightly interconnected. They don't just touch each other. If you eat rotten food, you are going to get sick, right? If you eat food that is maybe not rotten, but is unhealthy because it has contaminants or what, in the long term, this is going to be bad for you. And I think that we have to understand that, as we said, we are the ones in charge, not only of our lives, but even of the lives of other living beings. And this includes plants and the environment.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest is Professor Ilaria Kapwal. We're talking about One Health. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. Though this week, we're talking about a lot more than just animals. We're talking about sort of the health of all of us. My guest is Professor Ilaria Kapwal, and we're talking about One Health. When we left off, in fact, we'll go a little bit further, you had alluded to human travel. And if we think back to the example of the ancient Greeks, their travel extended to what? Throughout the Mediterranean and maybe through the Middle East as well a bit. But we, as you say, now travel thousands of miles. Mm. I mean, a person can be across the globe in less than a day. Mm. And of course, there are risks inherent in that type of behavior. Of course, the ability to spread infectious disease quickly. I mean, airplanes are kind of compact environments in which we are situated in close proximity to one another. And that is a good way to spread a disease should it be present. And we might be interacting with folks who have been somewhere quite far afield from us.
One of the risk factors or the drivers for spreading infectious diseases are, for example, so it's human travel, but cruise ships.
Ah.
So those are a very good environment.
Yeah.
Because they, much more than a plane, because they stop, you get off, you go to the beach, you go and do your thing, you get back on, so you can get exposed to a pathogen, you can be bitten by a mosquito. Plus, cruise ships are big things, and they have, you know, a big part where they keep all their stocks and for food and all the rest. And, you know, are there going to be mosquitoes in there in this ship? Yeah. Are there? Are we going to carry potentially new invasive species? Yes. And so we need to maintain an open mind, because as you know, we do more and more, could we be spreading diseases in a way that we'd never thought about?
And potentially, you know, just environmental degradation. I mean, cruise ships are, as you say, large, and they're getting larger all the time. Reducing the spread of infectious disease on something like a cruise ship might be a problem that has no ready solution.
Well, no, but, you know, I think that finding easy, ready solutions is not of this world anymore. I mean, nothing is easy nowadays.
Yeah.
And we understand more and more the complexity. But this doesn't mean that we don't have to look for new solutions. We know that the old solutions may be limited, okay, in their outcome. And that's why we have to look for, and that's what science is about. That's what research is about. I mean, basic research is important, but applied research is also important to bring that research to the end user, who is our listener, who's listening to us just now.
You mentioned earlier about bees. For the most part, bees are this invisible force in our lives that, for being mostly invisible to us, have one of the greatest effects on our lives of any other sort of creature. And that makes me think of agriculture as a whole, right? Agriculture is, of course, a huge business worldwide, but the effect of agriculture on our environment is substantial.
It is. And I would really like to commend UF for actually identifying some of these areas as priority areas. So, for example, well, there was recently a bee lab that was put up in IFAS. Mm-hmm. And so we have a bee lab, which is great. We also have several institutes around campus that address issues in a more complex way. And they address certain issues even towards sustainability. So, for example, there is the Center for Stress Resilient Agriculture, which is headed by Diane Rowland. It's within IFAS, and they are looking at how can we develop an agriculture that is more resilient to, for example, heat stress, to a drought. Okay? So they are actually looking not at how, you know, to put more chemicals to make the plant flourish, but they're looking at how can we stimulate the resilience of the plant to help it in these more difficult times. There is the Institute for Sustainable Food Systems, which is also in IFAS. It is mainly on fisheries, and it is also about sustainable fishing, because fisheries and fishing, it poses very big problems of sustainability. It's one of the biggest problems there are in agriculture in Europe, because of the impoverishment of the breeding mass of fish, and therefore fishing needs to be regulated. And so we have an institute there. We have, of course, the One Health Center, which is actually a center which is supposed to bring all of these different perspectives and points of view together. I would like to just detach ourselves a little bit from, you know, in diseases and infectious diseases, and just highlight a few other things that are part of One Health, given that it's our self-imposed One Health Week. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we are organizing for mid-November a One Health International Symposium, and this is quite a pompous name for an exercise which I think is absolutely necessary. And this is getting faculty who work around the same problem, but looking at it from different angles, around one table, especially when we're dealing with problems in low-income countries or low-resource countries. So this symposium on November 19 is organized actually by Olga Munoz, who's my PhD student, together with the Livestock Innovation Lab at Animal Sciences. It is a very big effort. It is a project which is about developing improved livestock performances in countries that are under-resourced. And one of the areas that they were working in is aflatoxins. So aflatoxins are toxins that come from a fungus that is found in crops. Now, UF is very strong in aflatoxin research. There was actually very recently a grant that was funded on developing novel technology to identify aflatoxins in crops. But the big problem about aflatoxins is that they cause liver damage. Mm. They are highly toxic for the liver. And therefore, when you detect it in food, whether it's food for people or food for animals, you need to make sure that, you know, if that food is contaminated above a certain level, it doesn't get into the food chain. And you need to communicate the information that this foodstuff or this food could be unhealthy to a population which is not particularly well fed. Mm. How do you do it? And so we have planned for a meeting with the Livestock Innovation Group, Center for African Studies. We are going to focus on Ethiopia and on Rwanda, because this is where Livestock Innovation Lab has their teams. And then we have someone from the One Health Center, and we have a team from IFAS that can talk to us about the new technology. And so the whole idea of doing something for under-resourced countries in an interdisciplinary way, because we don't have solutions that are, okay, stop eating it, because this cannot be done, right? So you need to identify ways that will preserve health and, on the other hand, will not destroy the local economy or the trust that people have in institutions or in organizations, because they say, oh, but you're saying we shouldn't eat this, but maybe we should, but maybe what's the standard? So they start questioning.
Right. And for all the effort that scientists and researchers might do to raise awareness and help find solutions, you might also have the competing interests of large corporations that, you know, might stand to lose something by having to change.
So no one wants to change. Right. This is, I mean, we don't want to change. We don't want to go the same way home. We don't want to go that detour, right?
Right.
And so even the big corporations don't want to change. However, I think that there is now a completely different approach, which is mounting inside some corporations. We've seen it already with corporate responsibility and philanthropy. And I think that we are probably in a better position than where we were 5 or 10 years ago.
Well, that's good news. Yeah. The potential for these sorts of meetings, these sorts of collaborations seems substantial, but perhaps the organizing of these sorts of collaborations is substantial as well. Your graduate student would know that. Is this the future, though, of problem solving?
Well, I don't know. If I knew that, I would be maybe doing something different, so I don't know. But what I can say is that I came to UF about 2.5 years ago, and I see I have learned and I have explored and I have met with some fantastic faculty who do wonderful work, but they just do it in their own room or in mm-hmm. their own office mm-hmm. or in their own laboratory. And it is very difficult to break those barriers, and it is very difficult to get people's attention, because, you know, there's pressure on young faculty, and, you know, everybody has his or her own agenda. And but I am absolutely certain that if we can get 3 or 4 of these, I would say, truly cross-disciplinary collaborations. And by the way, in the Ethiopian, in the One Health International, we have the College of Journalism. Yeah, we have the College of Journalism. So we have involved Anne Cristiano, mm-hmm. who is part of the College of Journalism, and she will talk to us about how you communicate, I would say, difficult or complex news
yes.
to a group of people who maybe aren't that educated in that field.
You have hit upon something I think that is so important. And you're right. I think that for many of us, the image of scientific endeavor is the sort of lonely researcher toiling away in a lab kind of doing an isolated activity. And of course, science is nothing without sort of putting your research out there, but that is communicated among other academics in the same sort of field, and the public remains largely ignorant of these things. And I think that that happens because the ability of non-scientists to convey information accurately, but in a way that is understandable to the broader public, is not ideal.
I perfectly agree with you. Communicating is a skill, and I don't need to tell you this because you work in the College of Journalism, and we all have different skills. There are scientists who are brilliant scientists and brilliant musicians, but don't ask them a question because mm-hmm. they'll start shaking. And there are scientists who are good communicators. And actually, I think that especially now there is an immense need for good scientist communicators. And I'm inviting you to invite me to come here and talk about fake news in science, which is another gigantic problem, but that's for another time.
Well, you know, I have a close dear friend who is studying obesity research. She does obesity research. And of course, with a topic like that, it isn't surprising that she would get approached by the media to discuss some of her findings. Now, fitness magazines or magazines for women especially see sensational possibilities here, right? The research shows this or this, and they talk to her, and then they publish a story that completely misinterprets what she had said. And this is very frustrating to her, and I imagine that at some point, many scientists will experience this frustration.
Yeah, so you always have to check things that other people write. That's the problem. I mean, you either have a very good relationship with the journalist or you need to check it. Because so I don't think that there's any malintention. It's
no.
just that journalists need to tell a story and they need to put a narrative together. And so at times, it's like, science is like stones coming out from you have a pond and you have these stones that are surfacing, mm-hmm. But you need to connect them because you can't put a story together just with the stones. And so at times what journalists do is that, let's say, the glue between the stones is something that maybe isn't that scientifically sound. And then that's why scientists get frustrated. And then they say, no, I'm never going to do this again.
Right.
And that's wrong. So I think that scientists need to understand that communicating is an art. And it doesn't come for free. You need to put yourself together, think about what you're going to say, and say it right. Rehearse it. And also, okay, there's another two things that I think scientists need to do. They need to be more engaging with the public. And so they need to speak a language which is understandable by the public. And They needed to speak a language. And they need, and this is, okay, this is about me, not about anybody mm-hmm. else. They need to come down from that ivory tower. Because the ivory tower is going to backfire mm-hmm. against science. Not against individuals, maybe against individuals, but this is beyond the point. The ivory tower is not for the third millennium.
Well, and there are already many people in the general public who are skeptical of science, which I find curious. You mentioned earlier that these are complex problems. Effectively communicating to folks who are not scientists the nuances of complex problems is going to be a challenge, because now scientists are not only going to need to be good at their jobs as scientists, but they're going to need to be able to do the work of communicating. Now, this is something that veterinarians have to do, because veterinarians will interact with the public in the same way that doctors do. A good doctor who can communicate with you is going to be a much, much better doctor than someone who might be a brilliant intellect but has no ability to communicate with you as a patient.
Empathy.
Right.
Empathy. And it's not only with people. It's even with pets. You know, some pets, they recognize people who are empathic towards them. I actually have a cat at home who is not a particularly social animal, but a friend came to see me and the cat just started walking towards him and jumped on his lap. And I said, "What's wrong with you? Like, this cat always ignores everyone." And he said, "I do this to cats." And so it's empathy. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't forget these soft skills, because yeah. these are extremely important. But there is one point that I really would like to make, and this is about the difference between scientific truth and absolute truth. So knowledge and science are constantly evolving, because what is true today can be wrong tomorrow. Not because today we were trying to misbehave, but because we need to learn. And as we learn, we do better. Okay? So, for example, surgery. Now, if you do any type of surgery, they try not to open you up. They'll try and do it with non-invasive techniques. In the past, it wasn't like this. Why? Because we didn't have the non-invasive techniques. And we were cutting up people and animals. Is this wrong? No, it's the best that we had. And so going back to my concept about real truth, scientific truth, real truth in science doesn't exist, because we are a moving community who moves onto new ideas, new theories all the time. And so what we have in science is relative truth. It is truth that is at that point in time, and that is, you know, the best that we can figure out with the tools we have. And so when you say that there are people out there who will criticize whatever a scientist says, okay, so some of them, these are like the people that think that the earth is flat.
Right.
There's lots of them. Lots. Like lots. Okay, so that's another story. However, the I would say stakeholders more than people, you know, the stakeholders out there who look at what we do as scientists and look at what we do as veterinarians or as doctors or as psychologists, they assume that we have absolute truth. We don't. And we have relative truth. And so this is something that I really think we need to communicate, because we need to make them understand that we are trying our best, and what is best today might not be the best for tomorrow.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFTFM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today is Professor Ilaria Kapua, and we're talking about One Health. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT. I'm Dana Hill. My guest is Professor Ilaria Kapua, and our discussion this week is about One Health and One Health Week. And Professor Kapua, let's talk a little bit more about some of the stuff that's going on in One Health Week, especially anything that the public can get involved in.
Okay, so there is an international One Health Day, which is celebrated on November 3rd. Which is homecoming. And so we couldn't celebrate on homecoming because you can't park, you can't move, you can't breathe. Right. Okay, so we decided to have a One Health Week, which starts on October 29, and it goes all the way up to November 3rd, which is the One Health Day. We have launched a contest, which is an art contest, and we will be rewarding the winners, as I said, on Monday 29. We will be meeting in Smathers Library at 4:30 p.m. We will show the artworks that we have received. We will make some interesting, we will draw some interesting conclusions on where One Health is in at UF, mm-hmm. and we will give ourselves some targets for the next One Health Day next year and how we can grow it and grow the awareness and the interest on campus and beyond campus. Because this is not only for the UF community, it's for the Gainesville, the Alachua, the Floridian community.
In your position here as a director of One Health at the university, are there equivalent sort of positions at other universities around the country?
There are One Health centers in different other universities. There's a One Health unit at the CDC. There's Colorado State, California. UC Davis has had a One Health program for a very long time. But, UF is one of the very few campuses in the United States that has all four colleges. So it has agriculture, it has the vet school, it has public health, and it has medicine. And it's a comprehensive campus. And so this is the perfect place to make it fly, if I can only break those silos.
Yeah, in fact, all of those things in basically one city.
In one city. And we're all here. We just need to find the glue and get people to move a little bit out of their comfort zone and look into this, which I think is a great area for research in the next years. Let me just say one thing. Antimicrobial resistance, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So antimicrobial resistance is superbugs. So are these bugs that have a super genome that enables them to be completely resistant to antibiotics. So if a bacteria is resistant to an antibiotic, it means that the antibiotic will not work. And therefore, it means that the person or the animal or the plant that is infected with this pathogen has limited chances of being treated and may die. And antimicrobial resistance is a very big issue, because we have suddenly realized that we as a community, because we did not have a One Health approach, have driven antimicrobial resistance, because by using, I would say, antibiotics and drugs in animals in a way that isn't targeted and isn't controlled. This is a worldwide problem, mm-hmm. so it's not only here. We have supported the selection of resistant bacteria that then we can get in our food or in our water or in the hospitals. And that's even a bigger problem because some of these resistant bacteria are like hospital infection, the so-called yeah. hospital infection.
Right. This is something that we've kind of brought upon ourselves in many ways because so many of us go to the doctor when we're sick and either we sort of, I don't know, we kind of make it seem like we're not satisfied unless we leave with some medicine. The doctor gives us some antibiotics when, I don't know, maybe we got a virus or something and these antibiotics aren't going to help us in any way at all. And we end up just creating a situation in which, you know, things become more resistant to antibiotics. Am I getting it right there?
Absolutely. So antibiotics do not work against viruses. Antivirals work against viruses. So if you have a virus infection, you don't need to take antibiotics. You need to take antibiotics if you have a bacterial infection. Now you say, but how can I figure this out? Well, your doctor will know, and don't push to get antibiotics if you don't need them. And the reason is because once they are in your hands, they are either going to be swallowed by you or by one of your family, or they're going to end up in the trash.
Mm-hmm.
And if they end up in the trash, they're going to end up in the environment. And we don't want that. That's the last thing we want, that our drugs, our prescription drugs, end up in the environment.
I mean, there's already so much stuff that's in the environment that we're only learning more about now. I read something the other day about microplastics. The potential ramifications might not be really obvious to somebody like me just yet, but it's still something to think about that the behaviors that we engage in, throwing away medications and the like, these might come back to haunt us in the future.
Okay, so there are, as a European, there are two things that really get under my fingernails here at the U.S. With reference to One Health. These are, first of all, batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Can we find a better way to dispose of batteries? Do we have to throw them in the trash? They are poison. And I actually would like to, you know, this is an open call. At UF, let's not throw batteries in the trash. All we need is bins in the different departments, and let's collect them. And, you know, show other people in Gainesville, in Alachua, in Florida, in the United States that we care. So batteries is one, and drugs and pharmaceuticals is another. Because in Europe, you would never even dream of throwing out a drug in the trash because there are places where you convey them and they will collect them and they will hopefully neutralize them before they are dealt with.
Well, I do think that you're onto something here, and that is that if the resources are available, if the options are out there for people, people will learn to change their behaviors, right? If it's easy to recycle something, right? Like it's easy for me at home to put aluminum cans or plastic bottles into my blue recycle bin and the city comes and takes it away and that way it doesn't just go in directly into the landfill. I do it because it's so easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to take it to the recycling center myself and that was like across the town or something, I might be less inclined to do it.
That's true. And I think that as I have seen in many places in Europe where you do have bins for batteries and mm-hmm. for drugs, I think that UF could do it because UF is a very forward-thinking university and it is mindful of environmental issues. It has a lot of programs around and it has such a complex and interesting environment, you know, with all the freshwater springs and the seas and it's just a beautiful environment. And I think that, you know, as the people who are the intellectual community in UF, you know, maybe we could do something at least about these two components of our everyday life that we use. And we really shouldn't throw them in the trash. Every time I have a battery, I like carry it in my pocket for a week.
Looking for the right place to get rid of it.
And I say, I don't want to throw it. But in the end, I have nowhere to throw it. Now, if I had a place on campus where I could throw the battery, I would take it.
Well, you're listening to the show, UF. Let's do something about it.
Let's do it, please.
Well, we're up against the clock, Professor Kapua, and the time goes by really quickly. I've really enjoyed our conversation. I really hope that next time we speak, you'll be able to tell me how it went at the One Health events this year, and maybe you'll know about what's going to happen 2019.
Maybe, and I hope that by next time we talk, maybe we will have something moving around the batteries and around the antibiotics. And if we're not, we'll talk about it again. And you'll ask me, and we'll continue to nail it until somebody does something about it.
Well, Professor Ilaria Kapua is a director of One Health at the University of Florida. Thank you so much for speaking with me again. I really appreciated it.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful.
I want to thank all of you for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live.